Welcome back to Red Spotlight Entertainment. Today we're going to have another show for you today called To The Table. We will be watching two separate films that the other person has recommended for us that we have not seen previously before. The first film, which I recommended towards my good friend here, Alexis Soto, is Spielberg, the new documentary on the famed director. And the documentary that Alexis Soto had for me was some fucking Star Wars. I don't know.
So the movie that I selected for Peter was the Star Wars documentary, Empire of Dreams, which documents the making of the classic trilogy, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. And the film that Peter, quote-unquote, selected for me, even though I had every intention of watching this on my own.
Sure, so you did.
I was going to watch this. It just so happened that you beat me to the punch because I actually had, I don't know, work to do. So, we'll say that Peter selected this for me, but in all honesty, I had every intention of watching it. So, and that is Spielberg, the brand new documentary on HBO on the life and career of the best working director today, working today and for many, many years, Steven Spielberg.
So, Mr. Soto, the reason why I so kindly recommended this film for you was because deep down, first of all, I knew you were never going to see it. And second...
Well, that's false, but continue believing that.
Fake news.
Fake president.
Whoa. You have respect, sir. It's not right to question your president. Don't you know this?
But he questions generals all the time. So if he can question anybody, I can question him.
Yeah, well, fake news.
Fake president.
The reason why I gave you this film, Alexis, is because I know how very much you are in love with Mr. Steven Spielberg's work. He is quite easily your favorite director. He is someone you consider to be the best director ever, working now or ever. I think it's more, definitely more debatable. But I also saw the, I kind of accidentally saw it because it had just come on and I was just going to see a little bit of it and then move on. But I ended up just sitting there and watching its entirety. Because I just loved it, and it was just so well done. So I was like, yeah, Alexis is going to love this. So that's why. I was like, that's your next film, Alexis, for To The Table. And this is where you tell me I was correct.
That was quite the explanation. Mm-hmm. All I can say to that is, by the way, this thing just was released, like, in the past week or so. So
yeah.
Like, you can probably still catch it on HBO, if not, just go on HBO Go. Kyle. Anyway. This... best movie of the year.
Really?
I'll just put it right there. Best movie of the year.
Ahead of The Last Jedi?
Well, Last Jedi hasn't come out yet.
Oh, so all of a sudden, it hasn't come out yet.
Listen, it would be preposterous of me to say that I'm going to proclaim a movie that I haven't seen as the number one movie of the
okay,
year.
Okay, for
unlike
those listening,
people
go back
on this
to the podcast 69 and listen to him and Kyle saying it's already their best. It's their favorite film of the year.
Well, I never said such a thing. I think it was implied, but that was never confirmed.
Okay.
Kyle, on the other hand, did confirm that.
We have tapes.
We sure do. Anyway. I'm sure I said this before, that the documentary series, or the genre of film, I feel is one of the more personal and informative, and yet strangely emotional, genres of film that I think many people dismiss. A lot of people don't consider documentaries an actual genre of film, or seriously anyway, as like, you know, the drama is the one that's considered to be the highest of our genre.
If you're talking Oscars.
Of our film industry, a lot of people, the hierarchy goes with drama and then, you know, it goes all the way down and, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. But look, this was an absolute joy, an absolute, I'm trying to find the right word to do it justice, because I'll start off with this. Steven Spielberg is my favorite director. He was my favorite director before watching this, which obviously made me very interested in watching this. And why he was my favorite director, you know, I couldn't really probably articulate that well why he was my favorite director before. I can certainly do that now, having seen this. But why I would say he was my favorite before was because literally every movie he's done, or most of the movies he's done, are some of the best films ever made to begin with. Some of my favorite movies of all time. And I really feel that in his movies there was a consistent voice that, for whatever reason, without ever really putting it together, connected with me on a way that other directors' films necessarily wouldn't. And so a lot of this documentary actually focuses on the big hits that Spielberg has made. It starts off, you see Jaws, Close Encounters, Indiana Jones, E.T., Schindler's List, and Saving Private Ryan, I think, are the ones that are, and Jurassic Park are the ones that are mainly focused on. And those are his most recognizable films.
Schindler's List?
Yes, Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, Jurassic Park, Jaws, Close Encounters,
Siriana?
Indiana Jones.
Was that?
Siriana.
Oh, no. What was the one that has to do with Munich? Sorry.
Munich. Yeah. Munich, the focus on The Color Purple. Mm-hmm.
They actually do hit quite a bit of his filmography.
Even toward the end, Munich, and then I think they also hit Lincoln. They cover mostly the ones that work. Some of the ones that didn't work were kind of just glanced.
They're like,
it's there.
They kind of happened, I guess.
Yeah, I guess they do. But at least they don't shy away from the fact that they didn't work.
Yeah.
So, and especially the one that they get into. Well, before we get into that, just so much to say about this, because they also do. They go into his filmography. They go into also his evolution and his growth as a director, from his early beginnings to where he is right now. But what I love so much about this is that you actually get to know the actual person. From what I read, Steven Spielberg is one of the more private individuals or public figures that we have in our society. He would never really do many interviews over the years. And it's really strange because, you know, who doesn't know Steven Spielberg in these days? Like, he is someone that has a name to himself that people just – he is a household name. That's who he is. So it's really strange that this is actually one of the first pieces made in which he obviously gave his full blessing, because he was completely transparent and open about literally every part of his life. And I think – the filmography and his love for cinema takes center stage here. But what also is not looked over or glanced at, which I'm very happy, is the man behind the camera and his early beginnings, his family troubles, his religion. It really kind of, in 2.5 hours, gives you a really nice picture of who this person is, who he has been throughout his life, and where he's continuously going. And I just have to say, the more I saw of who Steven Spielberg is, the more I ended up really, really loving the man in a way that, you know, before, you know, Steven Spielberg, I love his films, but I could never really say that I had an inkling, maybe an inkling, but I didn't really know much about him personally. And I think this movie really helped to give you the full picture, in a sense. And I just have to say that because of this, we'll say little documentary, I feel he has really become now an icon to me, because a lot of what I saw in him as a person, how he carries himself, his ideology, his philosophy in life, his candidness about looking back, obviously the sentimentalist, the idealist, the patriot even, as he calls himself. There's so much of myself that I saw throughout his life that it really kind of clicked for me why I feel his movies are so huge on me. And when you see this documentary, you really get to see that Steven really injects a lot of his own personal life into a lot of these movies, into the relationships and the way he writes the characters and how they go. And it really just shows you the storyteller he is. I know I think back to that scene in Saving Mr. Banks where you have Walt Disney talking to P.L. Travers at the very end of the film, where they both pretty much tell their own terrible stories about their parents and how sick and tired they are thinking about it having ended that way. And what storytellers really do is they can find meaning and closure in writing better endings to those stories. And so, in a nutshell, having watched this, I identify so much with who he is, with who Steven Spielberg is, that it really made sense for me why all of his films really do resonate with me on a deeper meaning than most other directors. So, there's my spiel for now. So I'm going to toss it back to Peter to see... I'll make sure he laughs at me for being sentimental, and then we'll go forward with what he thought of the documentary overall, and then some specific scenes that he liked.
First of all, spiel.
Yes.
Okay, that took a lot of chutzpah.
Chutzpah. Not chutzpah. Chutzpah. You gotta pronounce it right.
Everything that you're saying right now, watching after having watched the documentary and like letting you know you need to watch that, that's exactly what I knew you would gravitate towards, because that's kind of what I gravitated toward. Everyone knows the great films Steven Spielberg's made, because he is easily the most recognizable director in the entire world, the world over. And for many, he's going to go down as the best director ever, and la 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 la. But like you said, there you don't really see much behind that anywhere else, but you see it here. Like his family dynamic and the things that really stood out to me, that really, for me, it's able to like pinpoint it and say, this is it. This is why either he's so successful or he just resonates so well with people. And I'm just going to start jumping around. Or do you want to start from the beginning?
Honestly, you can jump around, because I'm going to be jumping around.
Okay.
Because the truth is, there is so much that to take away from this throughout his entire career from any point that we're just going to... It's basically a free-form discussion, okay? Mm-hmm. Bear with us, but I implore everyone right now to go see this.
Oh, yeah.
You need to go see this.
It's a great documentary. It's a really good film. And this is something that you can already... The reason why I'm starting with this is because you can already see it in his films, but you never realize at just what a deep level it really came from, although you probably should have, because when you direct something, that really is pouring yourself into whatever you're making. Just the relentless sort of optimism he has.
Yeah.
Like, even when he would try to make darker films... people would notice, film critics and, film buffs, or like he would still would never be able to commit fully to just cynicism. He would never be able to just get lost in the darkness. He would always have to just add a tinge of optimism and life into it, no matter how dark the material he was covering. It could never just end on and everything was terrible. Yeah. You know, and I think they really touched on that when they were talking about Empire of the Sun.
Yeah.
And the way he really took the ending of the film in a different way, and where a lot of people are like, oh, there goes Spielberg having to do what he does
best.
Happy
ending.
Yeah.
Also, The Color Purple was one of his more savaged films, probably the most savaged film, mm-hmm. because he was adapting something that was very un-Spielberg, mm-hmm. and he took it... He didn't go, I think, what Kathleen Kennedy... By the way, this documentary is filled with A-list talent, yeah. and icons and idols, like Kathleen Kennedy, your Kyle Peter's favorite. but I mean, Kathleen has worked with Spielberg pretty much her whole life, so it's obviously it makes sense. But she said herself, like, Steven could never go where the writer of The Color Purple could go. Because from what was said in the documentary, it was very much... And I think this might have been the early 80s. It was like a lesbian heavy thing.
Yeah.
And it was only just barely glanced at in the movie, and he was savaged for that decision anyway.
And I love how he just admits, like, I don't know. I couldn't do it. Like, he's like, today maybe I probably could, but it's just,
oh, today would have been fine.
Yeah. But he admits it's just like, I don't know. I couldn't go that way. I couldn't commit myself fully to doing that. And you definitely see later on in his career, I don't think, because he does more serious and slightly darker films, even up till today. But I don't think it's like his outlook on life changed. And they touch on that. It's more that he just wanted to challenge himself to see mm-hmm. if he can push himself. But I think right. even in his darkest film, and for me, that's Schindler's List, there's always this humanity that he brings into all of his films that is just relentless. That's always there. And I think that's the reason why he has resonated so well with so many people, because everyone can really gravitate towards that, his humanity.
The long yearning for humanity. We always think of ourselves in society. We think of ourselves that we should always be better. Mm-hmm. And it's in times like these, and it didn't just start with Donald Trump. I know we deride him, but it began a while back. But we're in this perpetual state of cynicism and acceptance of nuclear warfare and the apocalypse. We're living really in what can be described as the dark times. And Peter will admit to this as well as I, that in recent days, probably in recent months, outlook on humanity, it's been taken a beating. And it's really hard to find the goodness in people anymore.
Well, it's just like every time you turn on the news, it was like 3 hurricanes, 4 earthquakes, the worst shooting in American history.
Fires, tornadoes.
The president attacked some veteran, and it's just like everywhere you look, it's tough. It's tough times.
Even in the entertainment industry, as we discussed before, with our very own Screen Junkies and obviously in Hollywood, there's just everywhere you look, there is just a perfect storm of cynicism and darkness heading our way. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Peter. A lot of the reasons why his movies work is because he refuses to give in to cynicism. Mm-hmm. Whatever movie he's doing, he always brings that humanity in himself and injects that into the identity of the film. And going back to what you're saying about how he wanted to challenge himself is because, and like I said, we're going to be skipping around here, mm-hmm. but this was at the period of time before Saving Private Ryan, before Schindler's List, and definitely before Jurassic Park. This was right in the aftermath of the commercial, quote-unquote, the commercial hits of Jaws, E.T., and, of course, the Indiana Jones trilogy.
Oh, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I still haven't seen.
Oh,
so
my God.
I need to see that movie.
You really do?
I've been meaning to see it for a good year now. I haven't had the chance. But that was Spielberg coming off those hugely successful, quote-unquote, commercial hits.
Sorry for butting in. But what's so interesting with that is everyone in the film industry kind of looked down on him because he was this very young. He got this big contract. And, like, immediately, right away, he was making these big hits that everyone loved. And I think in this form of jealousy, the way people would push back against him is by saying, well, those aren't real films. Those are audience films. They're not real films. And I think I think they never really touch on it too much. That did get to him, though, a little bit, the way that they would view what he did as not art, even though, and they go through it, he really imbues himself into those films, especially with his family life.
Yeah, they just happened to be commercial hits.
Yeah.
Those are all amazing films. Yeah, I mean, Jaws is known as the first modern-day blockbuster. That's the one that began the blockbuster. But Jaws, I mean, I don't think it's anybody's idea of an actual blockbuster, though. It's like, it's really...
The blockbuster has evolved.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, but it's like it doesn't have your big special effects and action sequences and this. But here's where my issue of it, where I took issue with the criticism he was receiving, and it kind of reminds me of the way George Lucas would look on the establishment, or even Walt Disney himself is. And I think Walt Disney said this when they asked him about why would you make a cartoon into a movie? Why would you do that? And they were like saying, well, and then after when it came out and it was a success, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, of which I'm talking about, they were like asking him, they were telling it actually to his face. Well, this is actually really great for the kids. And Walt Disney was, well, what's wrong with anything that's great for the kids? And I think, if you go back even to its early, conception of cinema, there's always been this bias or maybe this misunderstanding of films that aren't quote unquote serious. We're seeing the exact same thing today with, I would say, Marvel films. Yes, I take the check of Marvel
Studios. Take the time. Check the time right now. Yes. What's the time? How long did it take you? 25 a minute. Oh my God.
Kevin Feige pays my bills, so I have to mention this every time.
This took quite a while before you mentioned Marvel. I'm impressed.
Exactly. But in all seriousness, look, as you and I have said on many times, Marvel Studios creates more than what people would conceive of mindless entertainment. And we don't even have to keep it to Marvel Studios, because when you look at Marvel Studios, you have something truly special with either Winter Soldier or Guardians of the Galaxy. And then when you look at some other films like Logan or Deadpool, or even, and that's just a subsection of it. There's also the blockbuster genre, like War for the Planet of the Apes or Blade Runner 2049, which isn't really a blockbuster, but it still kind of fits into that whole box or whatever.
It's a great blockbuster.
It is. A lot of those kinds of movies, and obviously you can add in the Star Wars films there as well very easily. A lot of those movies, no matter how great or well done they are, they're not considered serious films, and they're not considered serious film making. And
well, I have a response to that, Alexis.
God. What is it?
If that's your issue, do not worry, because Wonder Woman has been noticed by the Academy. So don't you worry. Big blockbuster filmmaking is finally getting its shot. It's finally being recognized.
and they can burn in hell for that, because it is just another example of elitists and snobs in our industry. Here's the thing, though. In all seriousness, I've been feeling this for like a long time now, mm-hmm. that a lot of the movies that audiences crave, that audiences love, that are actually good movies themselves, I feel that they're just ignored. And it's a lot. You'll notice that they're all commercially successful films, like Spielberg's early films. I mean, this mentality, I'm trying to say, seeps back all the way back to Steven Spielberg when he was accused of, he's too popular to be an artist. His films are too successful to be taken seriously. All the way back to Walt Disney when he, a pioneer in filmmaking, created the animated film genre, was not taken seriously at all in the beginning. You see this resistance, this bias toward other genres of films. And like I said at the very beginning, the hierarchy of the drama has literally been there since the very beginning. No matter how many new things or how successful other kinds of films are, this mentality has permeated and has persisted throughout, I would argue, decades and decades back, half a century back at this point. So Spielberg just happened to be caught up in it. And I think unfairly so, because like, I don't know how you can dismiss films like E.T. and Jaws and Indiana Jones, because I'm telling you right now, and you know mm-hmm. this, those are some of the most recognizable movies in filmmaking ever.
Well, to be fair, it's easy to say that now. We're looking at the
now,
people
yes.
when they first right. came out, when there was no such thing right. as E.T.
But what I'm saying is, like, to propel my point forward,
yeah.
when it comes to Spielberg or Walt Disney, those films have become icons in and of themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
Not the way that they were received when they were released. I mean, mm-hmm. when they were released, they were popular, sure. But like looking back on them, they've all are iconic films.
I agree with you somewhat. And I think you know the place in which I agree with you, because this is something I often say. I never understand why for some people a film isn't good unless it's really serious and dark.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. That's my point. Yeah. That's what I'm trying. Where is it that you don't agree with me? I just want to be clear. I don't know, because that's basically what I was saying.
Yeah.
I was just giving examples.
Well, I guess it's Marvel. I see all of Spielberg's like.
So you're saying Logan shouldn't be in the conversation for Best Picture?
Don't you do that to me. Say? Don't you do
that. That's what, exactly what you're saying.
Saying.
I was making the point. You're saying Blade Runner shouldn't be in the conversation?
Of course they should. Of course they should.
Okay, it's not just Marvel.
I know. My thing
I'm
is...
I'm giving the example because they're popular movies that are commercially successful.
There are some examples of that. Like Avatar right. was nominated for Best Picture. The Last Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King won...
Right, Mad Max Fury Road,
Mad
but
Max.
Again, the trend. What's the trend? It's only one.
Yeah,
there's every year if there's one.
They always give one token mainstream film.
The Lord of the Rings
yeah.
won Best Picture. That was like the rare example that actually wins something.
Mm-hmm. But I do agree with you that that's kind of my big issue with the Oscars. It's like it doesn't really celebrate all of filmmaking. It celebrates best dramatic filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it's not just the blockbusters. It's
the
horror,
comedies,
it's comedy.
It's yeah,
it's literally anything that's not a drama or a biopic.
Yeah,
let's be real here.
Those are
or
the only two that make it into the 99.9%.
Every now and then, the indie gets in. Like Moonlight was an indie film in that one.
It's mainstream enough, though. I think
it's mainstream because it had the promotion.
Yeah,
but it you know what I mean.
But yeah, but I think what's great about that, what happened with Spielberg, is when he's like, okay, like I understand what people are saying about me. I don't believe them. What I do think is art, and I would agree with him. But then also he's like, okay, let me push myself. Let me try more serious films, and right, when serious, right. I mean the tone of the film. And then he knocked it out of the park with that too. And he's created classics.
Stumbled. Well, first he stumbled somewhat. Because like The Color Purple or Empire of the Sun. But
Even those though, I think if you look back today, I know The Color Purple, the film. Empire of the Sun, for a lot of people, is a classic. Yeah. So Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List and Munich and some of his other films, I like that because it's like, okay, you can't just scoff and push him away and say, oh yeah, you know, pat him on the head, good job, Steven, you made really good family films. Like, no, it's like, no, you can't ignore him anymore. Now you have to admit he's a great filmmaker.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, like, the latter part of his filmography, I think is probably in large part a response to the pushback of his earlier part of the filmography. Because, first of all, he shut every one of them up when he released Schindler's List. Probably his masterpiece, his magnum opus, Schindler's List. A movie that I will say for me is the hardest film to watch. It is such a bleak. There's humanity in there, which kind of makes the movie successful. But why that movie is also so successful, because the brutality and the carnage it's not removed from it. It's exactly what you thought it was and worse. And Schindler's List is such a masterpiece, as Kyle would always say. Well, he says it's a classic.
He says
it's such a classic of a movie. And that was, I believe, the first film that Steven Spielberg directed that won him Best Picture. And I believe Best Director. And it all happened the exact same year where he released a little movie called Jurassic Park.
Like, I think that year just solidified him as like...
Yeah.
That there's no questioning it anymore. He delivered just the best drama, most heartbreaking, incredibly well-made film of the year, maybe of his career, with Schindler's List. And then he also made this amazing, fun thrill ride. Just
that was a pioneer. A pioneer in special effects
in the same year.
In the same year.
So it's like,
it was really interesting. There's no denying that. There's no denying it, and I'm glad that the documentary made such a point out of it, because it's a two-in-one in a huge year with Jurassic Park. When you have people, and I love how they included Lucas, because you know how he has special effects. Did you see him just like foaming at the mouth of like the realization that Jurassic Park was just like, it opened the gateway for the Star Wars, The Phantom Menace, and others following
The Phantom Menace.
The Phantom Menace, which also was a visually spectacular movie.
Yeah.
Visually. But again, because what did they show? Because computer generators or CGI, is that what it was?
Yes.
Or what
CGI was, it? Was basically created with this film.
Steven was like, he tried going to props, basically what Lucas would do when he made the Star Wars films. I need to make something this big, but it needs to run. That wasn't going to happen. And Steven's like, they need to run. So it's like, we got to figure out some way. The timing was perfect for it. And that really did change the industry in a lot of many ways. And also Jurassic Park is an iconic movie. I mean, that spawned a franchise, literally.
It's an incredibly well-made movie, too.
Yes. But then also when you have Schindler's List, which was such a personal movie for Steven Spielberg, because that was him basically reconnecting with his Jewish faith. He had made it well known in the documentary that for a large part of his life he shied away from it. He was ashamed of his heritage because it made him so different from everyone else in the neighborhood. That plus the estrangement with his father and the broken family. It was just this collusion of things that came together that really made him very agnostic, I would say, and probably very bitter toward his heritage about it. And I think it's very important how he was able to reconnect with that. And if he hadn't reconnected with that faith that he and his family, I don't think it would have been that successful of a movie, because Schindler's List is impeccable filmmaking on almost every level. And it is such an emotional devastation of a movie. And do you think there's a better movie he's made? I mean, do you think Private Ryan would be on there?
Some Private Ryan, but I mean,
I think it's Schindler. Nothing
he's made has moved me as that last scene when Schindler just breaks down.
Yeah.
He's like, I could have saved more. And they all tell, like, no, like, look at all these people who are alive because of you. And that's what I'm talking about, his humanity right there.
But Oscar Schindler was a shady guy.
But that's great.
From the beginning of the movie, yeah.
Because it's
that's why it's great, yeah.
It's not just, and I think they touched on this in the documentary as well, it's not just a movie about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is the backdrop against this character, Oscar Schindler, where it's just this a regular shady dude who is really rich. He really doesn't care about anyone else. He really is all about himself, and he's just thrown into the worst time in world history, modern world history. And the way, you know, the fact that he chose to do something about him, why did he? We may never know, but was he just affected by everything he saw? Was he always a good person at heart? All we know is this person chose to do the right thing and save so many people. And that's what the story is about. And I think that's why it always works, that film.
And, I mean, also around that same time, and Steven Spielberg is not just a director. He is, probably you can call him a mogul if you want, but I mean, he co-founder of DreamWorks Animation, mm-hmm. Founder of his own Amblin Studios. And then also because of, through Amblin, he's also produced several, I mean, he's produced a lot of movies, like the Back to the Future series directed by Robert Zemeckis, and so many others. But then came Saving Private Ryan. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, he's just made every kind of movie you could possibly. You want to see Steven Spielberg do a war movie? He just made the best one.
That's the thing that, so whenever people want to talk about, oh, like their favorite director of all time, I feel like you could name quite a bit of directors where if you said you felt that they were better than Steven Spielberg, I could understand, and possibly I'll probably even agree with some of them.
Yeah, and but, you have you prefer others to Spielberg. Just
I've never really sat down and thought about it, but there's
really okay.
But I don't think you can say the same about any other director who has attempted so many different genres and beyond excelled at each different genre. And I think that's something that's very unique. And that's why whenever people say, oh, Spielberg's the best, I can understand that. Because there's great directors out there, but they're always sort of in their own niche, either genre or type of film in which they make. Steven Spielberg will adapt to the different genres, and then he'll excel better than most anyone out there.
I mean, if you look at it, I mean, he's gone on to make other films, that, again, that people wouldn't take that seriously, like Hook or The BFG, some of his less successful movies, probably. But I think for the most, I mean, at least one of them, people like them for the most part, but they're not what they prefer out of Spielberg. But then also like Munich and Minority Report. But then also, he did, earlier in his career, one of his more savage movies, he tried making this comedy, 1941. Like, he really wanted to make that movie. Mm-hmm. I think it was with the airplanes, or it was some kind of war comedy movie. And that didn't really... I've never seen 1941.
I've never seen it either. I don't think I'd heard of it until I'd seen the documentary.
Yeah, I mean, so there's just so many movies he's made, honestly. But you know what's interesting? They all sound interesting, though. Like every movie, even though like Empire of the Sun, I haven't seen that one either.
Oh, you need to see that one.
And so it's like that was Christian Bale, and I'm like, and like the little kid was mm-hmm. Christian Bale, and I'm like, oh, that is because it cut a lot of. And by the way, this is kind of a reunion of sorts because they really do get a lot of the stars from the big movies, like Empire of the Sun to Lincoln and even Bridge of Spies, all the way going back to Jaws and Jurassic Park. They get a lot of really iconic, like Goldblum and Helen Hunt. And there's just so many people that they got together for this. Of course, the best living actor working today.
Let me throw this out there.
Yes.
After seeing this film, it did sort of answer something for me. And I now understand why Steven Spielberg will never direct a Star Wars film. Because you see that closeness that him and George and De Palma, Coppola.
That's another part of the movie that's so great because it also is going to be a connection into Empire of Dreams when we go into that. It was so weird how that came together because like De Palma and Francis Ford Coppola, Lucas and Spielberg were just, and Scorsese. They were like what's it called? The Rat Pack of music, like Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra, and Dean Martin. Mm-hmm. Like just this group of friends that ended up being legendary filmmakers. Go ahead, you're saying
they were on the outskirts, these young guys, of filmmaking, and they took over the film industry. Every single one of them, and this support group they each had for each other, and they'd support each other but also push each other, and each one of them just became these giant mogul successful guys, and they even bring in George Lucas to talk about it. They touch on Star Wars a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Steven Spielberg seemed like the only one who believed in it a little more. Everyone else was kind of like,
can we stop there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, truthfully, that's why we love him, because he has that eye. Mm-hmm. Like, how is it that, and of course Spielberg would like it, though, because I mean that's kind of what he loves in the kind of movies he was making those days. But again, it just kind of brings light to the fact that it probably wasn't that great of a cut that he showed.
It was a piece of crap, terrible. Probably.
I would probably, if you and I looked at it, probably it would be like, oh, George, I don't know. And Steven was saying that at that after they had a dinner party. And I don't know if it was like,
I think it was De Palma. Coppola.
De Palma was like savaging George. and Spielberg was like, George looked like he wanted to strangle him. It would be like you telling me Rebel sucks in front of my face. Oh, wait, that actually happened. Oh. Me actually getting aggravated. So.
But his criticism made the film better.
Better. That's right.
Thank you for proving my point. Right. Thank you for proving my point.
You know what? That was a big fail on my part. But in the actual movie, mm-hmm. that was... I had to pause it because I was like freaking out. That the whole idea of the crawl came from that like that little dinner party mm-hmm. thing. And it was just so crazy. Like... just the little things, you know, that of where things come from to where it ends up being in the final movie. It's just incredible. It really is. But I also wanted to go ahead.
No, go ahead. Cause I was just going to change it to something else, but go ahead.
Well I was too, but.
Oh, I was going to say, I think it would be interesting to talk about the politics behind him. Cause mm-hmm. I think that's something that really endears me to him. And honestly, to this day, I don't know if he's a liberal. I don't know if he's a conservative, but his outlook on patriotism and really, he's. I feel like he's never taken a left-right direction really with his films. It's always about attempting to do what is right and doing it mm-hmm. the right way.
But I will say though, mm-hmm. It's a kind of. Add a little bit of a layer and a nuance to what you were saying. The politics have changed throughout his entire filmography.
Oh yeah.
To the point where things that were considered to be agreed upon by both sides of the aisle are no longer agreed upon. And one thing to just note while you're making your point is in Bridge of Spies, which is a very political movie, James Donovan, the main character, was the patriot. He was doing the right thing. while everyone around him was telling him to do the politically correct thing. But the thing is, though, James Donovan was portrayed as the real patriot because he was standing up for Abel Rudolph's rights.
American values.
That's, but you see, it's the movie is a commentary on fake patriotism, on this flag shrouded patriotism. It's very much reminds me of this whole debacle we have with the NFL taking a knee thing, about this whole fake pseudo patriotism. And yet, if you really look at it, James Donovan was the one who was looking out for the life of this person. He didn't deny that he broke the law and that probably should be in prison, but he fought like hell to save one life because that is what the law demanded. That's what this country demands out of patriots to do, not just wave the flag and...
You're going to go off on a tangent.
I'm not going to go into it. Just go. Take over with that.
But I understand what you're saying, where he did have a definitive message he was trying to push with that film, and I love that too, because he never shies away from pushing a definitive message, but for the most part it's always do the right thing, like when they're talking about Munich, and basically the message of that film, or the discussion for that film, was does vengeance really solve anything?
I need to see that, because that's the one that looks the most interesting, because it pretty much was like it propelled both sides on a very controversial issue. And then apparently it ends with just ambiguity.
It basically ends with, it wasn't like, yes, we got the terrorist. It's what did we solve? You know, the ones we killed are being replaced by guys probably even worse. And then this continues.
What did we really accomplish?
They kill us, we kill them. They kill us, we kill them. And perpetual war. And then I never noticed that the end of the film. And I've seen that film, and I never noticed that it ended on the Twin Towers. I saw it a long time ago, so maybe that was it. But
this came out. It's one of his movies that was a response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. Along with War of the Worlds, apparently, which I don't remember that movie.
You don't remember it?
I remember it coming out, and I think my mom saw it, but I never... I would be too scared to see something like that, okay? So I wouldn't see that.
I really enjoy it. I'll put it that way. But I don't deny the fact that politically, and it, like I said, not a left or right thing, but just this idealism of we need to attempt to do what is right, that... is always pushed, and again, it's pushed again in Lincoln.
Yes.
That's something that I really gravitate towards, and I love seeing that combined with his almost, you know, supernatural optimism that he's able to hold. All that combined really infuses his films with the humanity and just the magic that. I know for myself, that's what pulls me towards his filmmaking.
Yes, and to just touch a little bit on Lincoln, because they do go into that, that, honestly, I didn't really think about it until it was pointed out, but it really was rather ambitious to tackle Abraham Lincoln in that light. And again, it really, what I love so much about his portrayal of events, which I think are more true than anything you'll get out of a history book, or out of a, no offense to your uncle, out of a history lesson. And I know he loves that movie too. That movie came out when I had him as an instructor, and we were both loving it so much. But what was so good about that movie is, you know, we have this conception, and even President Trump used this as a LOL line at the debates when Hillary Clinton compared herself to Honest Abe. And, you know, that got a real laugh out of the conservative audience. And I'm here just thinking, I don't know where this whole Honest Abe thing came out of, but he basically lied and was a pretty dirty politician to pass the 13th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody with a history book that doesn't refer to the Civil War as the war against Northern aggression, which that happens in half of the states in a region which I will not say, which should be pretty obvious. Anyway.
New York?
The Civil War happened. There was no way to end it in a clean way. And Abraham Lincoln did the right thing. And again, it's one of those issues, like, you're right, it shouldn't be something that's left or right. Mm-hmm. It should be something that's decent and patriotic. And I don't know. It just seems to me that with every movie he makes, he has something that he sets out to do. He has a commentary that he likes to do. And I know, especially with Bridge of Spies and Lincoln, those movies resonate with me so much more than I think more people our age, and a lot of people kind of dismiss the movies in general. But I think it's a very important commentary to have, and they're both really well-made films as well. I think in a similar situation, which will be with The Post whenever that comes out, which I'm also looking forward to. But to kind of wind things down with Spielberg, can you think of any favorite instances or moments of this documentary that stick out to you?
Instances
that like made that had an effect on you or moved you?
Probably his relationship with his father.
Oh my God.
In which he
that was tough.
He at a young age just sort of pushed him away and blamed him for everything, and he didn't even realize he kind of wasn't the one to blame. You know, it was his
mother.
Turns out his mother fell in love with someone else, and he blamed his dad for breaking up the family. And it really, in a way, it's what propelled him to be a filmmaker, because he just pushed himself into his work. And and you can really see those issues come full force into the his filmmaking. But then when he gets to the point where he's like, he reconciled with his dad, they're closer than ever. And he made what's it called?
Saving Private Ryan
for his dad, who served in World War II. So it's,
and I love how Spielberg also just comments on basically admitting a lot of the reasons why you have this father-son dynamic or father-daughter dynamic in all of my movies is because of this, and it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. It's a common trope that Spielberg gets accused of, whether it is in E.T. or basically in any movie that he does. But like you see a lot, they used The Last Crusade as an example of the relationship that Stephen had with his father, with Sean Connery and Harrison Ford there. And they also show his father, who's 100 years old, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, he's 100 years old.
Because he looks pretty good.
He's 100 years old. Hmm. What's it called? The father would, like, he caught on to this father-son estrangement in his films, and he would feel very hurt by that. And so it was very nice. Saving Private Ryan was literally for his father. Mm-hmm. Isn't that such a nice thing, that the power of what movies can do? And how and where they can go. One of the things that really touched me was the reunion, and basically the, I don't know what the restart of another relationship with his parents. They came back together at the end.
Yeah.
After years of separation. Isn't that just, I don't know how to describe that except magical. When you have two people that just fell apart and then they find their way together at the end of their life. It's also kind of sad because I did read that she passed away earlier this year.
Oh, wow.
In February. She was 97 years old. She was 97 and he was 100.
He's still 100. What do you mean
he's
was?
He's still 100. It's crazy. And it's also crazy. Stephen is 70 years old. And it's like, what? Like I can't bring myself to think that he's that old, because...
I don't know what it is with the family. Maybe it's no pork, but they look really good for their ages. He doesn't look 70.
He's older than George, and he looks better than George. No offense to George Lucas.
Well, yeah, but
that's a whole different thing there. I will say, though, to kind of bring this to a close, like, one other thing that connected with me is his upbringing and his loneliness and his the fact that he was bullied and he was alienated by many in his town. I personally connect with that because that's how I felt like throughout all of my early years in elementary school.
Oh, I thought that's you're going to say that's how I felt like in the last podcast.
No, no, Peter, no. I know you're a friend. I would never question that. I mean, to be serious here, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I felt like. I mean, a lot of us do come from backgrounds that aren't very pleasant, and I don't like to reflect on my childhood very much, especially when it comes to with school, because it wasn't a happy time for me at all. And that sense of just being lost and feeling you can learn things. Like for me, like a lot of the things that I know, I didn't really learn from school necessarily. I picked up on my own. I picked up them up because I like them and that's what I like to do. And I love how Steven just doesn't, like, you really get a sense for his personality here. He really is a big nerd. I mean, at his core, he just loves these things and he always has. But I think the moment that really touched me the most, and I hadn't really thought of it that way until it was pointed out, was toward the end where they were talking about E.T. E.T., it really, I had not thought about that movie in such a long time, but it reminded me why it was one of my favorites growing up. And it was at that last scene where, obviously, we all know the scene where E.T. is saying goodbye to Elliot. He's about to fly away in his spaceship. And what was, I remember as a kid, that would destroy me. It really would. It was one of those endings that I remember, one of my earliest memories just experiencing. But it was pointed out by somebody in the movie that there are no two humans like Elliot and E.T. And that's really what Spielberg does, is this humanity that we all should strive to be, that the fact that everyone... in like the mother, the little girl, Elliot, or the scientist, or whatever he was, the fact that they could all empathize and relate and feel compassion for this creature that is so different than they will ever be, the fact that they could make a connection like that, that's how I see things. That's how I view the world. And I feel that in so many ways we lose ourselves when we seek to alienate, when we seek to push those away who are different than we are. And it didn't really click until it was pointed out to me that in that instance, that's how I became who I am, is by watching that movie in a way that I had never realized. So, and yeah, I was crying a lot, so I just had to stop it there because it was just a mind-blowing event for me.
No, but that's the power of filmmaking right then and there. You don't even realize the way it shapes your life, but it does. And I can name similar instances to movies growing up where it's like, wow, like, I want to be like that. I understand what's going on. Maybe not at a deep level, but it's like... movies do have the ability to change people for the good, I think. And yeah. I think Spielberg, his work is, like, I don't know if I would name him, like I said, because it's just not something I ever really think about, the best director of all time. But mm-hmm. He definitely always deserves to be in the top, tippy-top discussion of it. And I think
and he's still going, though. He's one of those, he hasn't lost his touch. He's still going. We got many more movies to go with him, and I can't wait.
Ready Player One, that's coming up. That's the one I'm actually hoping is good.
I'm hoping for that one. I'm looking forward to The Post, because mm-hmm. I love those kind of movies.
Two very different kind of movies too.
Right. But then also Indiana Jones 5, whenever that'll get made.
Oh, I'm not they need to cancel that. That's just let it go.
Harrison's not going to let it go.
Why?
because he loves that character. He just loves it.
I don't like being an ageist, but he's just too old.
Okay. Now, that is very ageist of you. I will just end this conversation by saying, if you have not seen this movie, go. Because I don't... this is a film that moved me in so many ways, and it solidified why I love Steven Spielberg so much, why I relate to him, I connect with him, and I identify with him in so many ways. I love that man, and I love what he continues to do, and I hope I see so much more from him. And now so we can move on to something else that we all love so much, Star Wars. When do we never talk about Star Wars?
I don't think we ever talk about it.
No, probably not. So another documentary, The Empire of Dreams, which you can all watch on YouTube, by the way. Another one of my all-time favorite documentaries. I know I put this on all the time before a new Star Wars movie comes out. Whenever I get in a Star Wars mood and I don't feel like watching the movies themselves or the shows, I put this on because this usually does a good job of getting me in the mood. And like we said earlier before, it's pretty much an overview, but it really is an in-depth assessment of how hellish these movies were to make.
Specifically the first one.
The other two had their problems for sure, but nothing like the first one. You might even say it's, I don't know, Solo-ish, some of the problems that are happening. Damn. Okay, Peter, tell me, well, first, I already told you what I thought of Empire of Dreams. Go ahead, start off with this.
Well, it was a movie. I think when you talk about this film, you need to always begin with the man behind the movie, which is George Lucas.
George Lucas.
And
a pioneer in filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely.
A pioneer, absolutely, and so many other ways.
But it's interesting because he's just so different than his buddy Spielberg, and then he refers to himself this way. He was more rough around the edges filmmaker, you know. It's none of these fancy shots or these things right here. It's just we go in and we shoot what we need to shoot. And when he got to Star Wars, he had already made
American Graffiti and TFXI. TFXL, TFXI? Which one was it?
THX.
THX.
When I always forget the numbers.
You know which one we're talking about.
American Graffiti, and then it was this film right here, which is the last film he would make for a long time.
Well, reportedly.
Reportedly.
We'll get into that later. But what was so... what you get so much with this one is... again, the different approaches. Steven Spielberg was somebody that very much was more than happy to assimilate, or not assimilate, but he was more than happy to cozy up with the higher ups and to establish relationships and work within their guidelines. George Lucas was not. He was the Bernie Sanders, if you will.
He was.
If the movie industry was the DNC, George Lucas would be Bernie Sanders in a nutshell.
He was as anti-establishment as they came. He hated the studio system. He hated it with everything inside him. He fought against it. And it's funny because I know he said this quote. I can't remember if it was in the documentary. I think it was somewhere else that he's... he said something along the lines of, for him, movies ended when they created the talkies. He very much is, he says this, I'm a visual filmmaker. You know, that is, dialogue is just there because it has to be there.
That sounds very George Lucas. Yes.
And that's what I mean when I talk about the differences between him and Spielberg. Spielberg is all about that human connection, and George is all about that the visual, fighting against the machine, really, and that visual storytelling you can take films with. And I think both of those really influenced his magnum opus, Star Wars.
I mean, there's just so much to go about it because he just so many different iterations of it. I think there was this one thing where it was called The Star Wars initially, and he wrote a screenplay that was overly long.
By the way, can we agree he never had a plan for Star Wars?
I think we can agree that the details that ended up being probably aren't what he had in mind originally.
But, like, he talks, like, in some interviews, he's like, oh, yeah, I always planned for there to be 9 films. And then he says, oh, no, there was only meant to be 6.
Okay, that's just not. But what I was getting at is that he said that he wrote essentially what would amount to the original trilogy in a single screenplay. And he was like, well, I'll just take the first quarter of it and make that into a movie. And that's where you have Star Wars.
But, I mean, Star Wars was changed so much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was changed because, again, like we've said in the past that, first of all, it was changed, like, top to bottom. You know, that Han Solo was originally this frog creature. Mm-hmm. And as you see when they casted for the movie, when you brought in Harrison Ford and they found Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, the dialogue, what the hell was that?
And honestly, that was something they really did not change.
Well, I mean, it got better, a little better. It wasn't that bad. I mean, that was just like outrageously insane. I mean, I think in Star Wars, there are lines that are, I think, more straightforward than what they had in the casting call.
Well, yeah.
But like the thing about Star Wars is that so much for like, as George Lucas is an anti-establishment, anti-studio director, this was an effort by the director and the studio. The studio did help out, especially the head of 20th Century Fox took a lot of grief from his board for greenlighting this and putting more money into this. Star Wars was a disaster of a production and literally the most classic sense you can actually put it in. From an exploding budget, I'm sure, to just them running out of time. I think they said that the last, they had to film in 1 week, I don't know, 3 weeks worth of scenes, just because that the set was going to be torn down and that was it. So you, like, the president of 20th Century Fox was like, hey, George, you need to finish this now because I can't stop them. I can't go to the next meeting and say that this movie is still being made. It just isn't going to happen. And I know that George Lucas even, like, he had heart attacks or something. He had, like, chest pains. He had to check himself into the hospital because of the stress out of making this movie.
I mean, and you can, every time, because they have footage from them filming, and you never see George Lucas smiling. He just looks so broken. He's just constantly, like, sort of fidgety, and he's like, oh, my God. Oh my God, like that's the face that's on him constantly.
So much so that there was this part where Carrie, Mark, and Harrison did this bit to try and cheer him up. When it was that scene of the Death Star, they were running down the corridor, and then when they said cut, they would all like do like, ah, or they would just like, you know, do something ridiculously silly to kind of get him to like, you know, relax a little bit. Because they were actually concerned about George's health, I mean, literally. Much like Kathleen's health these days. Interesting. You know, it's like poetry. It rhymes.
Of course.
in so many ways, if you think about it.
He also had to fight the crew.
Oh, my God. That's right.
The crew is not like, on his side.
I think there was this instance where he was the one who was filming it, who was holding the camera, was actually not doing it the way I'm not going to go there, but let's just say that the director was directing the cameraman to shoot the scenes a certain way, and the cameraman was not doing it the way the director had told him to do. He was doing it the way that the cameraman thought they should be shot. So, yeah, that happened. But then from the actors didn't take it seriously. He had to fight the crew. He had to fight the studio. The story changed so often. No one really knew what this was. Everybody was just baffled by what this, like, this is walking carpet. What does that even mean? The Force? I mean, I'm God bless Alec Guinness. I mean, he was the one that I think was being the most professional. I mean, he is Sir Alec Guinness for...
You know what Alec Guinness was doing?
Mm.
Like, I'm sure in his mind, this little Star Wars project he was doing is similar to, like, when you're on Netflix and you're scrolling and then you see, like, Samuel L. Jackson and this, like, movie you've never heard of before that came out last year. And it's like this little dingy little movie that just somehow got some A-list actor to be in it to pay for a TV or something.
Probably.
That's what Alec Guinness was doing.
But from all the stories you have from everybody on set, he still took it serious.
Oh, yeah.
When it came to his performance. And that really counts for a lot. And you can definitely see that in the movie. But then also, from an editing perspective... The first cut of the movie was a disaster. When George Lucas says something is a disaster, it's more than a disaster. I mean, that's a real doozy right there. I know that there was this picture where he brought in these two editors, I forget their names, to cut the film to where it ended up being. I know he even had his wife, Marsha, at the time, Marsha Lucas, who was also cutting New York, New York by Martin Scorsese, which I still need to see that movie because it really interests me. So many movies... I'm just giving you ideas, Peter.
I know.
Okay, you make of that what you will. But in so many ways, like one of the last things that was interesting about the making of Star Wars was John Williams.
Yeah,
and the score that he composed was like one of the last things that was put into the movie because that was the last thing I think they were working on to make the compositional score. Thank God for John Williams. Let's just say, like, I mean, do you think the movie would be the same if it wasn't for that score? No. Not at all, right?
This abomination was like the happiest accident in the world.
You just called Kyle's favorite movie of all time an abomination.
It was. It was a travesty. It was just strung together, just the worst experience in the world. And they were able to magically... And I mean magically, something great came out of it. It's one of those happy accidents.
It was like divine intervention?
What?
Divine intervention?
Yeah. It's like that. It really is just an unbelievable happy accident, this entire film was. And I think the documentary does a really good job of showing, like, no one had any idea what was going on, including George Lucas. The visual effects were like, were some of them like destroyed, and then they had to go back and redo it.
I think he actually created Industrial Light and Magic just, while working on Star Wars,
just to
get that movie finished. There was so many instances where this all could have fallen apart easily. Then also, it also shows you how the reaction was opening night and the phenomenon it turned out to be. Because even though it is, as you say, an abomination, you would still say it's a good, great movie, right?
Well, I mean,
that you love.
We are on number 8 of the series with at least 27 more to come.
Yeah.
I think that kind of says something to the quality of that first film.
And several generations of novels, television shows,
video games,
comic merchandise.
Book. Oh, God, the merchandise.
Which was revolutionized by this movie. George was very adamant about being in control of the marketing because he knew very wisely that the studio was not going to promote this movie at all. And we still see that today where studios just, they glance movies to the side that they have no faith in. And so it was really nice for George to get that firsthand, to have full control of the marketing for his movie.
Also, he didn't really take a pay from the film, but he kept...
All the marketing
came. Merchandising.
Right.
He owned merchandising. And that was the first and last time a studio... ever made that kind of deal.
Can you believe that? Fox must have
been
pissed.
They must have been tearing their hair and their eyes out of their sockets. The biggest blockbuster hit of all time. And they do not earn any money for merchandising. That must have hurt them.
But as the course of time will show, another further twisting of the knife is eventually they would find a new home in Disney. And Disney is like the king of merchandise in itself already. So it's like,
bring in the money.
Bring
in.
That is true. But I mean, to be clear, though, 20th Century Fox doesn't own the original trilogy.
No.
All 20th Century Fox owns is the theatrical version of Star Wars. And that's it. Because afterwards, George was like, yeah, I'm going to make more, but I own the movies. You don't get to own them. You can distribute them, but I own the movies. Then
at some point, do you think it just comes down to he just doesn't like sharing?
Maybe. I don't know. But I mean, he's, as he says in the documentary, he's just very, very adamant about having everything in his control, like doing everything in his way. I think your point is well taken. I'm not sure he likes to collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wants to do it all himself because he wants his idea to be what it'll be in the end. Which you can critique him for that, but that's who George has been pretty much throughout his entire life.
Well, I think another sort of interesting story within the documentary is the way in which George went from railing against the machine to becoming the machine. Really, at the end of the day.
I mean, he benefited well from that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But also, when it comes to the making of Empire Strikes Back, it just shows you he had the good foresight to bring in Irvin Kershner, his former mentor and instructor at one of the film schools he attended. That may have been the best decision he made for Star Wars was to bring in Irvin Kershner to direct Empire Strikes Back.
That solidified it as a franchise.
Yeah, it solidified it as a franchise, but he realized that Empire needed to work in a way that most sequels don't. It needed to live up to the original. And it ended up being a better made film. Certainly a better acted film, better executed than Star Wars. I think people will decide for themselves which they prefer. I prefer Empire Strikes Back. I think it is the superior film. Then again, it's Star Wars. I love all Star Wars. But with Empire Strikes Back, you saw in the documentary that, again, the budget exploded out of control to the point where they ran out of money. They ran out of money to make the movie. How does that happen? I mean, where did all the money go from, like, the merchandising? And, like, George had all that. Where did it go?
AT.
It's just so crazy how all of these movies came so close to collapsing. And then when we move on to... they also touch upon the big scene of Darth Vader in Empire Strikes Back, of how top secret it was. And I think a lot of us know our history, that when that was released, a lot of people, there was apparently a lot of emotional trauma or controversy caused by that, because people drama didn't queens. Believe. People couldn't believe that that actually happened. And
apparently, that's why that whole scene between Yoda and Luke was put into The Return of the Jedi, was because they said, I think they talked to a psychologist or whatever,
that people didn't believe it.
Kids would not believe it because it came from Darth Vader. So it needed to come from Yoda as well for the audience to actually believe that, yes,
yeah,
that's who it is.
What do you know? And then we also get into Return of the Jedi, which, again, another... Things never go according to plan with those movies, do they? He had intended for Steven to direct Return of the Jedi. And Steven was, I think, open to it, though he never really said he was going to do it. George had the intention of having Steven, but I don't think he ever had the chance to ask him because George kind of split from the DGA, the Directors Guild Association.
They had the audacity to tell him what to do.
Yes, and because of that, Steven couldn't direct a film that wasn't like in the DGA, so that kind of like... So he got Richard Marquand, who... I don't know anything else about the fact that he directed The Jedi, but it became very clear that George just got someone because he didn't want to be directing the movie himself, and I think it's pretty evident that at the end of the day, he ended up having to be there on a day-to-day basis, co-directing, if not directing the movie himself.
He basically directed that film. Basically.
And it still ended up great. I still love the movie.
I love it as well. I love me my Ewoks. Screw you guys.
And your upcoming porgs.
Porgs. George Lucas approved.
But yeah, what I love so much about this documentary is that it really just dives into how these movies came to be, how closely they were to collapsing, and yet it's because how close they came to being complete and utter trash what makes them special and what really became a phenomenon that I don't think anything else has rivaled.
Well, not even today. Since. It's still going strong.
Not even today. It's still going strong, and we're still talking about it. In so many ways, and I don't think there'll ever be a time where we won't talk about it. It's just how these movies... Well, I mean, we won't be the last people alive. Fingers crossed. anything else to say about Empire of Dreams, about what you liked about it, what you didn't like about it, anything to add? After you finish yawning.
Sorry. No, just that... It's an incredibly well-made documentary that really, like you said, exemplifies just the miracle that especially that first film, but also the rest of them really were, and that they turned out to this be this amazing, magical saga, or at least trilogy at that time, that literally everyone came to love. I love it just for seeing... looking at it from a directing point of view, and just the way this film that almost broke George Lucas mentally and physically just solidified his entire career and life, really, forever. He never had to make another film after that. But also, in a way, it's almost sad that he never did.
Yeah.
So
I wish he would have kept with it, because it really shows... I mean, because when was Jedi released? 85? Mm-hmm. 86? He wouldn't direct a movie until 99. That's a long gap. And obviously with Phantom Menace, who I think we both love the Phantom Menace for our own reasons.
Not for being a good film. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not a good movie at all.
No.
It's honestly a travesty if you think about it.
And that's why a piece of me was kind of happy when he sold Star Wars to Disney, because I was like, well, maybe he'll go back and dig out some of his old scripts and just make some small, very little money. Just test out these films. Give it a whirl. He hasn't done that yet. So it's like...
I think he retired.
Yeah. Success is a double-edged sword.
It really is. And I mean, we shouldn't really make light of the fact that... I don't think the prequels were really addressed as much in the documentary.
They mentioned them like at the very end. They're like, oh yeah, he's making new ones, kind of. It was more of just... They were mentioned in passing just to show how successful the originals were, that they spawned more films. And, yeah.
Well, I mean, you have The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, so...
and whatever JJ's doing for 9.
It says here that this was released in 2004. So this was right after Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, right as Revenge of the Sith was being made.
Yeah.
So I think this is at a time when people thought that Star Wars was coming to an end for reals.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, it would have been Episode 3 coming out the following year, and then that would have been the end of it. So for whatever reason, I'm just happy that that wasn't the end of it. And that we still get to talk about Star Wars all these years later.
Yay.
For better or for worse. But I do recommend, if you're somebody who loves these films and really wants to know more about them, go watch this. I think it'll really help you get a clear sense of and appreciate. I definitely appreciate this so much more because of having watched this. And I think any good documentary will do that. So please go out. It's actually very easy. Just go to YouTube, look up Empire of Dreams, and you can catch it whenever you want. Also, I will plug again Spielberg, HBO, go watch that. And, of course, you can always catch the great Dave Filoni on Disney XD.
Oh my God.
On Star Wars Rebels. Peter, anything else to say or plug before we go?
Nope.
Okay, well, thank you for being here. I think this was a very good conversation. I want to thank all of you guys for listening. If you want to catch To the Table, make sure to listen to us every Wednesday, if there is an episode. And then you can catch the Fantasy Fair on every Friday, either the Fantasy Fair main podcast or Once Upon a Retrospect. If we have any After Darks or audio commentaries, they will be uploaded on Saturdays. And, of course, the main Red Spotlight podcast will be up every single Sunday for the foreseeable future. We want to thank you guys so much for, just thank you guys for listening, whoever you are, how many of you are.
Hey, David.
Hey, David. We love making this content, and a lot of the things that we discussed here today is why we do these things. We love movies, and we love the art form that it is and what it does for us and to other people. And that's why we're here, because we love this so much. So thank you guys for listening to the table, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.